I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Parallax is you observe an object, you see a change, but that change is not really a change in the object, but just a change in how you relate to the object in your perspective of the object.
Welcome to the testing room of the Parallax Corporation's Division of Human Engineering.
Now please cross the chair. And you will sit down. Make yourself comfortable. And be sure to place each one of your hands on the box on either side of the chair. Making sure that each one of your fingers is on one of the white rectangles. Just sit back. Nothing is required of you except to observe the materials that are presented to you. Be sure to keep your fingers on the box at all times. Alright? Hope you find the test a pleasant experience.
On this edition of Parallax Views, you'll hear part two of my conversation with the controversial ex-Satanist turned Buddhist practitioner, Nicholas Schreck. In part one of our conversation, we discussed Nicholas's amazing book, now out in a new German edition, The Satanic Screen, an illustrated guide to the devil in cinema. In part two of the conversation, we shift gears slightly from the horrors of the devil to the horrors of living in Los Angeles, City of Demons. Kidding, kidding. I love you folks in California. That said, we will be discussing Nicholas's many adventures in Hollywood. Or perhaps more apropos, we should call it his adventures in Horrorwood, as Nicholas spent a great deal of time with many of yesteryear's horror icons, including Barbara Steele, Mario Bava's witchy Italian horror classic, Black Sunday. Robert Bloch, the man whose novel about homicidal mama's boy, Norman Bates, which would be turned into the legendary Alfred Hitchcock proto-slasher, Psycho. The abominable Dr. Fives himself, Vincent Price. The criminally underrated art house beatnik horror filmmaker, Curtis Harrington, and the British thespian Sir Christopher Lee, who revived the character of Bram Stoker's iconic vampire, Dracula, in many a 60s and 70s horror film, striking terror into the hearts of filmgoers worldwide. In addition, we discuss Nicholas's most notorious musical project, Radio Werewolf, and that band's appearance in the 80s cult black comedy Mortuary Academy, starring the comedy duo of Paul Bartel and Warhol Factory superstar Mary Woronov. If you're a fan of old school horror cinema, you're not going to want to miss this episode, particularly the discussions of Curtis Harrington. As I said, one of the most underrated filmmakers within the genre, his film Night Tide, starring Dennis Hopper, is a true classic. And of course, the legendary Sir Christopher Lee, who Nicholas actually collaborated with. So you're going to get details and insights into Lee's personality that have not often been spoken of, including the clearing up of some real misconceptions about this amazingly talented icon of the silver screen. And so, without further ado, Parallax Views proudly presents to you the second part of a three-part epic conversation with Nicholas Schreck. So I want to pivot into your work in the band Radio Werewolf and sort of your adventures in Hollywood. So how did you, could you describe for my listeners what Radio Werewolf was?
I could try. You sort of had to experience it to get it, and it was a very mutable and flexible phenomenon. But to get to the essence of it, Radio Werewolf started It actually began in 1981. The genesis of the idea goes that far back. But we actually formed it in 1984 when I returned from a spiritual pilgrimage to Egypt, where I had a vision of using music and sound as a magical ritual and as a force. And when I came back to America, it was the second term of the Reagan era, and the satanic panic hadn't quite taken off completely. But forming Radio Werewolf at that time, the initial impetus for it was to do a magical ritual disguised as a rock band. And the original idea, although it developed and changed based on the reaction, as with any artistic production, you have an idea and then you put it out into the world and the thing changes as it interacts with the public. The original idea was to be to take the cliche of an idea that was already starting to form of the occult influence of music, backward masking, all of these cliches that Christians believed rock music was doing, and to embody them, to become them, to take on the stigma of all of these cliches and be that completely, to push it to the hilt. And of course, it was done in the early period with a great deal of conscious black humor and even self-parody, which went over the heads of many people at the time. So that was the initial concept of Radio Werewolf. We presented our concerts as Radio Werewolf youth rallies, and there was a fascistic, cult-like ambience to the concerts that actually became very dangerous. And as I've said in many other interviews before, it was like the Sorcerer's Apprentice or Frankenstein's monster. It was an experiment that was created that got out of control, partially because in the social matrix of the satanic panic forming and in the Reagan era where you had this Christian repression, it in some ways it couldn't have been the best time to do Radio Werewolf, but it was also the worst time because in Los Angeles, where it began as a local phenomenon, it then created its own cult, and then it created the fear that a cult causes. So that's a basic description of how it began. And then it went through many different phases. The initial phase was from 1984 to 1988. And that phase concluded actually again 30 years ago yesterday, which when we're recording this is August 9th. But on August 8th, 88, this satanic rally in San Francisco called 8888, which has taken on legendary proportions. That was the conclusion of one phase, and then Xena became part of Radio Werewolf, and that was an entirely other phase in which we then moved to Europe, and that phase lasted from 88 to 93. So there were at least three or four distinct sub-phases to Radio Werewolf. Some of your listeners may be aware of it, and others I know just have a general idea of what it was, but that's a basic description of it. But to sum up, it was a magical ritual disguised as a musical project. At first as a traditional rock band, and then it developed into something much more than that, and actually became from the beginnings of the group that formed around it called the Radio Werewolf Youth Party, that mutated under Xena and my leadership into the Werewolf Order, which was a initiatory body and society beyond Radio Werewolf.
Right, right. And it's interesting because there's two things for me that sort of stand out about Radio Werewolf. A lot of people still like to go into the sort of controversial fascistic imagery, which oftentimes came off to me as a bit tongue-in-cheek in songs like Triumph of the Will. Then the other aspect is the almost the famous monsters of filmland influence, which I see most on display, and I think is best summed up through your appearance in a sort of Police Academy knockoff starring the comedy duo Paul Bartel and Mary Woronoff called Mortuary Academy. Could you mm-hmm. tell us a little bit about Mortuary Academy?
Right. Well, to the first point is, yes, there was this weird dichotomy of, and it was directly influenced by Forrest J. Ackerman, the editor and creator of Famous Monsters, who I knew personally, that whole 60s Monster Mania feel to the early 84 to 88 Radio Werewolf and the cult-like fascistic iconography. And then the song you mentioned, Triumph of the Will, which many idiots look at as a, you know, 100% unambiguous Nazi propaganda song. If they listened to the lyrics and the delivery, they would see the irony of it. But the thing is, I never interpreted these things. I let people interpret them the way they wanted to. And if they misinterpreted it wildly, I didn't mind. I let them believe what they want to believe. And that's why I don't tend to correct these misimpressions particularly, though I've communicated it a little more clearly. But so Mortuary Academy, and I spoke about this in an interview to Dangerous Minds not too long ago. Mortuary Academy definitely was like the epitome of the Famous Monsters horror part of Radio Werewolf. And the way we were cast for it was interesting. We did an interview for the LA music magazine Music Connection in 1987. And the script for Mortuary Academy that, as you said, is Paul Bartel and Mary Woronov, who had done Eating Raoul. Mary Woronov came from the Andy Warhol circle. They had already written the script in which there was supposed to be this. And we were known at that time. It isn't something we called ourselves, but the right-wing commentator Wally George dubbed us the most evil band in the world. And of course, that was the point. We played that image up to the hilt. And they had written a script in this black comedy in which the most evil band in the world is killed in a car accident. And then this corrupt mortuary brings them back to life as sort of animatronic beings. And the amazing thing was, the director, when he approached us to hire, we were the fictional band that he created, except he didn't have a name for it. So there are jokes in the script that existed even before he knew what Radio Werewolf was, where he was saying they could have been the house band at Dachau. And that kind of thing. So it fit the image of Radio Werewolf completely. And he was amazed that he didn't have to create a fictional band, that it actually existed. An interesting thing is the day we began filming Mortuary Academy, we were given a dressing room for the car crash scene. And you can find it online, I believe, to this day. And the dressing room we were given was the Masonic Temple in Wilshire, this gigantic grand Masonic temple with altar. And so that was our dressing room for Mortuary Academy. But as you say, that was the height and epitome of the horrific Famous Monsters part of Radio Werewolf. And I should say, as I've said before in other interviews, it was interesting and it was fun to do. And on a, you know, strictly pragmatic level, good for our career. But I didn't really feel completely comfortable with the direction that Radio Werewolf would have gone in. Had we continued to go in that vein, no pun intended, I think it would have exhausted anything I would have been interested in doing forever. So Mortuary Academy, even though to this now, the strange thing is, when we were hired for the film, Radio Werewolf was just a local phenomenon. We had a cult following in LA, but we're not known elsewhere. Now, the film is only remembered because of Radio Werewolf being in it. So that's the irony of looking back at life after all these years. But to me, it was interesting, but it was sort of a wrong turn because there were other more serious and deeper areas I wanted to go with Radio Werewolf's music, and it was a temptation to go Hollywood. It was a mainstream film made by Columbia Pictures. Cesar Romero was in it. It was a step where we could have sold out to Hollywood, and I was not comfortable with doing that. I had other deeper artistic aspirations than that. So I've always said that what happened is Marilyn Manson took my act of 1986 and made a career out of that. And had I not moved away from that direction, that's probably what would have happened, which is a trap I would not have wanted to go into, because what I'm doing with my work musically is much broader than that. That was just one facet of it. But it was an interesting experience, and it was, as we've talked about earlier, it was, I saw the machinations of Hollywood and how tempting it could be to go in that direction. And I made a deliberate decision personally to not go in that direction because of Mortuary Academy.
And I think through Mortuary Academy, you had some dealings with Mary Woronov, who goes back to the she was part of the Warhol factory. And I think you met some figures in Hollywood that you would later work with through her, correct?
No, that's absolutely okay. Not true. I did meet Mary Woronov and got to know her reasonably well on the set. And actually, what I talked to Mary Woronov, because I have never been a great admirer of Andy Warhol, and I actually think...
Me neither.
Yeah, I think his whole postmodern, ironic shallowness pretty much fucked up Western art gravely. I see him as a dead end for art. So... You know, but I was interested in Mary Woronov as a cultural figure. But what I ended up talking with her on the set, and she invited Radio Werewolf to her art gallery, and I got to know her a bit socially. What I talked to her about was Nico, who she knew in the Velvet Underground days, because Nico has always been a great musical influence and heroine, no pun intended, of mine. And so she told me anecdotes about working with Nico and knowing her in the 60s. So that was, but she didn't really introduce me to anyone in, if you're talking about the whole horror world of Hollywood, that was something I had been involved in since I was a teenager through an organization that probably very few people remember now called the Count Dracula Society, which was run by this very eccentric vampire aficionado named Dr. Donald A. Reed. And he was sort of a fulcrum for the horror world long before the word gothic existed. Whatever the genesis of it was in this, the people around him. And there was an old beatnik named Bongo Wolf, who had known Dr. Reed for decades. And Bongo Wolf had worked with P.J. Proby, if you remember who he was, the singer who was kind of like a poor man's Elvis in England. He was a bongo player, Bongo Wolf, and he became a part of Radio Werewolf. He walked around Hollywood since the 50s wearing werewolf fangs and a noose around his neck and had the manner almost of like a TV horror host, but he lived that way 24 hours a day. That was one of the characters that I knew from the old school Hollywood horror world.
And I know you've mentioned to me, also I want to apologize for getting that bit wrong about Mary Woronov, but mm-hmm. You mentioned to me in prior conversation that you were sort of mentored in a way, I guess, by Robert Bloch, who famously wrote Psycho.
Yeah, I met Robert Bloch at a book writers convention that it's too complicated to get into. But I had also met several people who pushed me into different directions in my life at this LA book fair in 1976. When I was a teenager, I met Timothy Leary there, who I got to know later under circumstances I've explained in other of my work. That would take us into wild a digression. But Robert Bloch was one of the first serious authors who looked at some of my writing and was encouraging and gave me practical tips about the business side of writing and how to edit a manuscript and took an interest in my creative writing at a very early time. So yeah, he was a kind of mentor to me. Though in retrospect, I have to admit, I'm not a great admirer of his writing anymore when I look at it, but he was very helpful to me in teaching me how to edit your own writing and how to deal with the practical side of you know, shepherding a manuscript to production, and especially having the discipline to sit down and write and finish, not to talk about what you're doing, but to actually do it. That was a lesson that Robert Bach taught me. And he's the author of Psycho, Yours Truly, Jack the Ripper, many horror short stories and many horror films.
And there were two other figures I wanted to mention before we get into the horror figures that you've worked professionally with. I know you've talked about having some personal encounters with Vincent Price and Barbara Steele of Black Sunday, another movie mentioned in The Satanic Screen.
Yeah, very, very important film, Black Sunday by Mario Bava. I get into it in detail because Black Sunday in 1960, when it came out, this Italian horror film that was sort of capitalizing on the success of the British Hammer films a few years earlier, Barbara Steele's performance, in which is called The Mask of Satan in Italy, so it's more thought of as a satanic film in Europe than it is under the name Black Sunday. Barbara Steele created the archetype of the satanic, diabolical witch, which was a mainstay in the horror films of the 60s and 70s. She really was the essence and embodiment of that. So, to begin with her, Barbara Steele, I met through the director Curtis Harrington, who Zena and I befriended in the mid-90s, and was also very much a mentor to both of us in different ways. Curtis Harrington, rather underrated, but cult horror director, whose own mentor, interestingly, had been James Whale, the director of Frankenstein, so, and Bride of Frankenstein, The Old Dark House, etc. And he, Curtis Harrington, told us about what he learned from James Whale, and Curtis Harrington sort of continued the lineage of being a mentor to Zena and myself. But Barbara Steele had been a friend of Curtis Harrington's, and Curtis would hold these salons in the almost 19th century style. He would hold these formal salons in his Hollywood home that was decorated in 1920s style and filled with symbolist and pre-Raphaelite art. And he would hold these very civilized soirees for eccentrics and weirdos like us, but also many people from the horror field in Hollywood. And so we got to know Barbara Steele there and continued to know her. And actually, even there, she was married to James Poe, a screenwriter who wrote They Shoot Horses, Don't They? And James Poe was a friend of Jay Sebring's. So all these things in my life,
it all goes back to Manson.
it always does. I mean, the devil and Manson are the themes that things keep returning to. So in speaking to Barbara Steele, I asked her about her marriage to James Poe, but just to show you how these karmic connections in my life and everybody's life keep rising in unexpected way, James Poe was one of the people who, after the murder of Sharon Tate and Jay Sebring and Frykowski, etc., went back to Jay Sebring's house to remove pornographic films and pictures from Jay Sebring's closet before the cops could get there, at a time when Steve McQueen was arranging the removal of drugs from Jay Sebring's house before the police got there. So all of these things connect. And Curtis Harrington, the host of these parties where Barbara Steele was at, was a good friend of Polanski. So the connections never stop. And then the first person you asked about was Vincent Price, right?
Yes, Vincent yeah. Price.
Now, Vincent Price, I met in 1969. My father was, as I've said before, he was sort of a beatnik and countercultural type of person, and very open and supportive of my interest in the macabre and the occult and even devil worship. I didn't come from any kind of background where I needed to rebel, because my parents were rebels themselves and they encouraged my more esoteric pursuits.
Well, I was reading at one point that your dad even took you to like an authentic voodoo ritual.
Yeah, that's true. That was the kind of family I was in. And that was a landmark in my spiritual development. In 1972, during the regime of the dictator called Baby Doc, the Duvalier regime in Haiti. He took me to Haiti, and through a minister of, I forget what, he was a government minister of some kind that my father got to know in Haiti. So he wanted to make sure that I went to an authentic voodoo ritual rather than the tacky tourist ones that were held for visitors to Haiti. And I can't even get into all that. But that experience was crucial, and I think that was 72, in showing me that the gods are real, that magic is real, that human beings are indeed, can be possessed by spirits. I witnessed it, and seeing Haiti, a modern republic ruled by voodoo, basically the government ruled by magic and voodoo, the Tutankhamun, the secret police of Haiti, dressed as the voodoo god Baron Samedi, the god of death. That had a huge effect on me, and showing me that occultism and mysticism and the rituals to contact the gods are not fantasy, but a reality. So that's a bit of a digression, but yeah, that is the kind of family background. So the same father who took me to a voodoo ritual as part of my education, one day he told me that I didn't have to go to school. And I hated school always, saw it as a prison, so I was glad to hear that. And he said instead he's going to take me somewhere, to a Sears Roebuck. And we went to it, and he brings me into a room without telling me where I was going. And in 1969, Vincent Price was at the top of my pantheon of idols, as it was true for many boys in the whole Monster Mania period of the late 60s. And so Vincent Price was sitting there and welcomed me and, you know, very friendly and cordial. My father introduced me to him, and that was the first time I got to know him. And then in the 70s, I met him again at a performance of Diversions and Delights, which was a one-man show that he did about Oscar Wilde in San Francisco, and socialized him with a bit there. And then the third time I met him at the 100th birthday party held for Boris Karloff at the Academy of Motion Pictures Arts and Sciences. I think that was in, must have been 1988. So that was the last time I saw him. But I never worked with him professionally. I just got to know him on that minor social level. But Vincent Price, as anyone could guess, was a major influence and inspiration to me, for sure.
Right, right. And even, I mean, there's even legends surrounding Vincent Price and his role in the abominable Dr. Fives. There's this whole rumor that Fives was, like, inspired by Anton LaVey. Maybe that could be another urban legend.
No. Again, like Rosemary's Baby, it's putting the cart before the hearse, so to speak. What it was is that, of course, Anton LaVey worked in a film in 1975 with the director of The Abominable Dr. Fives, which was made in 1970, I believe. And this film called The Devil's Reign, this is the only film where he actually appeared in the film and was hired as technical director, only major film, not Rosemary's Baby. Robert Fuest, the director who also had directed many of the Avengers TV series, hired LaVey in 75 to be in this mediocre drive-in horror film that was John Travolta's first performance, The Devil's Reign.
Also starring William Shatner and Ernest Borgnine.
Exactly. Out acting each other to an almost absurd degree. I mean, it is entertaining in its terribleness, as you've probably witnessed. But so what happened is exactly as the story I told you about Rosemary's Baby, where LaVey took this appearance at a movie screening and turned it into being a technical advisor and appearing as the devil. This typical thing of his to take a tiny grain of truth and magnify it into a legend. He retroactively, because the character Vincent Price plays in The Abominable Dr. Fibes is named Anton Fibes, he said, well, you know, Robert Fuest was influenced by me and he created this character based on me. There's absolutely no proof that that's true. And he had no dealings with him whatsoever. I mean, not until 1975, long after the film was made. So that was, again, a retroactive feathering of his cap.
Right, right. And it's interesting because I was mentioning the two people that you've worked with that I really wanted to get into, and I know we're going a little bit over time.
That's fine. We can take time. There's so many nooks and crannies of this epic that happens inevitably.
Well, I wanted to talk about Curtis Harrington because people do not realize that Curtis Harrington is I saw his movie Night Tide, which was an early Dennis Hopper movie. It's one of the most brilliant sort of artsy horror films that I've ever seen. And I just wanted you to talk a bit about who Curtis Harrington was and why he's so important and your work with him.
Right. Well, Night Tide is a film that had a great influence on me, and also Zena, who I'm sure can explain from her own perspective. She even saw Night Tide as a kind of metaphor about her own life, being raised in a kind of carnivalesque freak show as an attraction. But she will explain that in another context, I'm sure. But Night Tide is still a brilliant film, and it's probably Curtis's most potent and fully realized work. And it was part of a weird and not completely even recognized yet genre of almost beatnik horror that was very brief. And like I mentioned, this character, Bongo Wolf, who was a beatnik who became the bongo player for Radio Werewolf, he was part of this beatnik horror aficionado world of the 1950s. It's a subculture that was like proto-goth, but with a more beatnik, rebellious, ironic tone.
It reminds me of the Roger Corman movie, I'm thinking of Bucket of Blood.
Bucket of Blood, exactly.
With the great Dick Miller. You know, exactly. Underrated character actor.
Yeah, Bucket of Blood would be a great double feature with Curtis Harrington's first mainstream film, Night Tide, because they show that it's the beatnik horror genre. It's an underexplored aspect of the macabre. So, and Vampira, for instance, Myla Nurmi, who I got to know in the 90s, she knew Curtis in the 50s, and she and Bongo Wolf and Curtis Harrington and people like that were part of this very tiny world of macabre aficionados who adopted what in a popular cliche would be seen as gothic mannerisms and attire and references long before any kind of gothic movement existed. They were almost the beginning of that. So Night Tide came out of this bohemian macabre, and Dennis Hopper was part of that too, who was also a very good friend of Vincent Price and a fellow art collector. Vincent Price was Dennis Hopper's mentor in art collection. So Night Tide is almost like a beatnik fairy tale horror movie, and anyone who hasn't seen it should see it. It's a very dreamlike, almost neo-expressionist film. About, and if I explain the plot too much, it would destroy the fragility of the mood.
You have to watch it for yourself, folks. It's very, it's like phantasmagoric, is how
yeah.
I put it.
So Night Tide was one of my favorite films of all time. And of course, many of your listeners who are familiar with the history of Western occultism probably know that the legendary figure Cameron, who was the wife of Jack Parsons.
Marjorie Cameron, yeah.
Marjorie Cameron was in that film, and she was a friend of Curtis.
He made a documentary about her, I believe, The Wormwood Star.
Right, and I mentioned that in Lucifer's Leinwand, or The Satanic Screen. I mention all of Curtis's more occult-themed works, but he used Cameron quite a lot. He used her in a cameo in his later film, Games. Yeah, but Curtis... was one of the people in Hollywood that I had a genuine rapport with. And really, I mean, obviously I haven't lived there for 20 years for a reason. For the most part, Los Angeles is a narcissistic cesspool of competing egos and psychopaths, you know, all out to stab each other in the back on their way to some imagined road to stardom. It's a, you know, it's a hell realm, Los Angeles. But Curtis was this old world, cultured, bohemian figure, you know, from another era. And so we had a great rapport with him, and we ended up working on his last film, his very first film that he made as a teenager in the 1940s was The Fall of the House of Usher. And he was a great Poe fanatic, Curtis. And in this early film, which is still extant and which we saw at the Munich Film Festival, where we were invited by Curtis shortly before his death, he showed this childhood work that he made as a teenager in which he played the dual role of Roderick Usher and Madeline Usher as a, you know, I think he was 14 or 15, something like that. And then the last film he made, he filmed it in 1999 when we still lived in Los Angeles, was just called Usher. And again, in his old age, he played Roderick Usher and Madeline Usher. And he cast Zena as a lesbian poet who was part of the social circle of the Ushers. And in a way, the film Usher is really about Curtis. If you've ever seen it, it's filmed in his home where he had these soirees and salons that I referred to. And it captures his life and his personality. It is the essence of Curtis, his final film, Usher, which was eventually completed in 2002 with funding by Roger Corman, who was a friend of Curtis and who had, of course, made the most famous Usher version with Vincent Price. So all these things connect. So, and I was cast as the Usher's family priest named Father Hubbard, after obvious source. And so Zena and I were in, we had the honor and privilege of working with Curtis on that film. And the cinematographer was the late Gary Graver, who had worked with Orson Welles, but also on the side had filmed a lot of grade Z horror movies. So yeah, Curtis was one of the people I've had the deepest rapport with of anyone I know. And since he's been gone for about 10 years, I think now, it's a gap in my life because he was connected to the interesting old Hollywood bohemia. He was like one of the survivors of that era. And to me, a more important filmmaker than Kenneth Anger, though who was a collaborator and friend for a while until they became enemies. I think Curtis's work is deeper, richer, more poetic than Kenneth, who has more, you know, gotten more publicity and more ballyhoo.
And I wanted to just to continue on this thread of Curtis Harrington, because it's always been something that I've wanted to figure out. I've seen a few of his films, like the ones that come to mind are Devil Dog, The Hound of Hell, of course, Night Tide, Queen of Blood, and a little known TV movie he did called The Cat Creature. Mm-hmm. And maybe you can clear this up, because I feel like you may have a different interpretation than what I maybe saw in these films. I sort of saw his portrayal of women as sort of something to fear, something to be afraid of. You know, it seems like he casts women as the villains a lot, but I know you have a very high opinion of women. How do you think Curtis felt about the portrayal of women in his movies? What was he going for?
Well, the obvious thing that comes to mind is you have to understand, as you probably know, Curtis was flamboyantly gay at a time when that was a taboo. And he, even in the 50s, his films and his persona, he was, you know, completely unabashedly and unashamedly gay in a Hollywood where that was forbidden and could be career destroying. When it was an open secret, when you were open about it.
Much like James Whale.
James Whale, too, was openly gay in the Hollywood of the 1930s. So Curtis was continuing, and James Whale was Curtis's hero and role model. His sense of black humor, his sense of irony, and sort of the way, and because we talked a lot about James Whale, the way that James Whale made Elsa Lanchester in Bride of Frankenstein, this iconic, frightening, and yet almost goddess-like being, an otherworldly creature, I would say, having known Curtis, what you're sensing there is not a negative feeling about women. And as you say, I have a very high regard for women. That's even part of my spiritual practice. Curtis was hearkening back to the tradition in symbolism and pre-Raphaelite art that he loved, that entire 19th century movement of symbolism and pre-Raphaelite art, in which the femme fatale and the unattainable lady and the mythical divine feminine, sort of like Robert Graves in The White Goddess. So Curtis, I think his casting of women like Florence Marley in The Queen of Blood, or all of his other female roles of these villainous characters, I think it was he was looking at the femme fatale as a powerful, positive, demonic, but almost, a goddess-like figure. And I think that is the way Curtis looked at women, and he admired the strong women around him, like Barbara Steele, Martine Beswick, who was a friend of his, and Xena. He admired these kind of strong, almost iconic superheroine type women. So I don't think he intended that in any negative sense. I think he thought the dark side and the villainous qualities is what made them interesting.
Yeah, and you mentioned Martine Beswick. I would really recommend, even though it's kind of a bit campy, is Devil Dog Hound of Hell, where she plays sort of this satanic priestess type character. He's such an underrated filmmaker.
Yeah, even I mean, he did, like, he understood that film Devil Dog Hound from Hell was just hack work. He did it to, you know, to pay his mortgage on his house. That was not a labor of love. But even films like that he did out of necessity rather than artistic aspiration are imbued with his black humor and his style. And her performance in that, again, is another femme fatale vision. Martine Beswick, also a very underrated actress who never really was given a great role, but like Barbara Steele, you know, had this almost supernatural charisma on screen.
Right, right. And he, like I would say to listeners, check out Curtis Harrington's films. He's a director that, even when he did commercial films, you see the sort of auteur quality in all of his work.
Well, he was also very, as I've said, like Robert Bloch was a mentor to me in terms of the discipline and the craft of sitting down and doing your work. But Curtis had this he had a love-hatred relationship with Hollywood. He was a real artist and a poet in a industry that's only about commerce. And he actually didn't succeed very well at maneuvering between the business of filmmaking and the artistry of it. And I think that's why he never had the mainstream success he could have had. For instance, he was initially given the go-ahead to direct The Omen in 1976, and then Donner got the job instead. But Curtis often almost had an opportunity to make, you know, blockbuster-type films, but he was too much of an artistic bohemian personality to ever really fit into the Hollywood sausage-making cookie-cutter machinery, you know? And I just want to say, too, his avant-garde films from the 40s and 50s and early 60s are also now available. You can buy them on video, and they were greatly influential in avant-garde film circles in Hollywood and in Europe. So those are worth seeing too. They're practically unknown. And the film Usher is also available on one of those compilation DVDs.
Okay, that's great to hear. I forgot that Usher was out on one of the compilations, but I recommend his whole body of work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was a friend and an inspiration, and I think of aspects of things that he taught us all the time, and his sense of humor and his approach to artistry. It was a great influence on me.
And I mean, there's so many other avenues we could go down. I know you've known Robert Quarry, who was at one point supposed to be sort of the replacement for Vincent Price by American International Pictures. You've known William Marshall from Blackula, but one that I really want to touch on, because you've worked with him on, I believe, an album, Christopher Lee. The album you worked on him with was Christopher Lee Sings Devils, Rogues, and Other Villains.
Mm-hmm. Well, Christopher Lee, I had first met in, I believe it was 1978. I'm pretty sure that was the year when The Wicker Man, if you've seen that film, where he plays
one of my favorites.
I think that's
Summer Isle.
Exactly, where for people who haven't seen it, he plays the chieftain of a pagan island. And it didn't get any proper distribution in America, and so Christopher Lee flew to Los Angeles to premiere the film. And I was introduced to him briefly by this character I mentioned before, Dr. Donald A. Reed, who was the head of the Count Dracula Society, which you can look up online and figure out how this all connects to the Hollywood horror world. And he had known Lee since the 60s, when Lee had first come to America to appear in an episode of the Alfred Hitchcock show called The Satanist, in which Lee played a European actor who was also a devil worshiper. So that was the first time he came to America, and that he stayed with Robert Bloch, who was the author of that episode of the Alfred Hitchcock show. So Lee had met Dr. Donald Reed, and Reed introduced me to Lee very briefly at this premiere of The Wicker Man. In the 90s, I contacted him because I had started my own record label, Wolf Slayer, in Los Angeles. And I knew that Lee, his main aspiration in life had been to be an opera singer. He had only sort of accidentally wandered into acting, and his passion was opera. And privately, we would talk about Wagner all the time. And opera and classical music is really what he lived for. And so I reminded him of our brief meeting, and we had a rapport, and he invited me to his home in London, and I discussed this project with him of doing an album of him singing and performing various melodramatic villainous characters from opera and musical comedy that were his two passions. So together we devised the set list, so to speak, out of many, many songs we considered. And then we started rehearsing it in London and recorded it at Crossroads of the World, which is a very interesting historic studio in Hollywood, landmark studio from the 1940s. And now that was the first time Lee ever recorded a proper LP of him singing. And the interesting thing was, this was in the period after the Radio Werewolf Ritual had ended. I deliberately wanted to do something completely in another field. So this was getting into classical music and even country and Western. He sings country and Western songs on the album. We had a full pipe organ playing with the great classical organist Robert Israel played the organ, and Lee sang to that. So I wanted to do something completely different than Radio Werewolf. Getting back to my own theatrical roots, perhaps, sort of beginning where I began. And so that was the genesis of that project. But Christopher also graciously agreed to narrate the tour. Zena and I operated a kind of satanic tourist attraction in Hollywood at 666 Hollywood Boulevard in the mid-90s. And
Was that the Hollywood Hell House or Hell House of Hollywood?
Which, kind of like Radio Werewolf, was a deliberate magical ritual that had a particular goal in mind, which we achieved, disguised as a Hollywood tourist attraction. But in fact, it was also a magical operation. So we had wax figures of all of the most notorious figures in Hollywood history. And Christopher agreed to narrate the tour for that. So his voice guided people into the wax museum that we had at Hell House of Hollywood. And then the third project that unfortunately did not come to pass, which was, we both really wanted to do this, is I wrote a screenplay about the life of Bram Stoker, in which Christopher had agreed to take on the part of Sir Henry Irving. Do you know that at all? Or maybe your listeners wouldn't know.
No, if you could get into that a little bit. I know he had... Well, before we get into that, a lot of people claim that Christopher Lee, like, he hated Dracula because he always was playing Dracula in these Hammer movies. My understanding was that Christopher Lee actually had a deep veneration for Bram Stoker's Dracula and all kinds of literature like that, and he was more annoyed with how, as the Hammer films kept going on and on, they got farther and farther away from the original vision of Stoker.
Yeah, that's very astute, and that's exactly right. Now, I saw him become very testy and annoyed if people only associated him with what he would call that role, you know? But you're exactly right. In fact, he kept pushing Hammer films to be more faithful to Stoker's vision of the character of Count Dracula. It isn't that he hated it or thought it was undignified to play the part. As you say, he wanted to play the part the way Stoker wanted it played. Go ahead.
Could I comment real quickly? We can see that in Christopher Lee. He actually did a non-Hammer Dracula movie with Jess Franco, Count Dracula 1970 with Klaus Kinski.
Right, called a Spanish production called El Conde Dracula, or Count Dracula, which was he agreed to do it. He filmed it I think it came out in 1970. And you're exactly right, though. I do want to underscore that point. This is a false idea. He hated the way that Hammer lazily just stuck the name Dracula on a routine script that really would very often have nothing to do with Stoker's character. He loved the novel. He admired Bram Stoker. He had a vast collection of supernatural literature. Unlike many actors who became stereotyped in macabre roles, he actually had an affinity for what he always called the macabre rather than horror. And he edited many anthologies of horror short stories. So he took a deep interest in the field of the fantastic. He was friends with Dennis Wheatley, for instance. And he was a very literary-minded person, Christopher. He was a lot smarter than most actors, to put it bluntly. He was much more of an intellectual. So you're exactly right. So with Hammer, he just resented how lazily and how cheaply they exploited the name, but without really exploring the character. So he agreed to do that Jess Franco film, Count Dracula, because at least it stuck to the plot of the novel. But he was disappointed with the... It's an interesting film and has good performances from Soledad Morando, Jess Franco's great muse. Klaus Kinski is Renfield. Herbert Lahm is Van Helsing. Great performances, but really low-budget, tacky production values that weaken its strength. But I'm sure you've seen it.
Yes, yes. And the other thing...
What I wanted to say, no, that ties in directly to this project that we were... So I wrote this screenplay for the 100th anniversary of Dracula coming out. And Lee agreed to play the part of Sir Henry Irving, who was... Bram Stoker was, by profession, he was one of the managers of a theater in London, where Sir Henry Irving, who was one of the great theater actors of his time, performed. And Sir Henry Irving was the role model for Count Dracula. And strangely, he looks very much like Christopher Lee. If your listeners look online to see what Sir Henry Irving looked like, he was very similar to Christopher Lee. And when Bram Stoker was writing his novel, he based the character of Dracula on Sir Henry Irving. So I wrote a screenplay about the complicated relationship between Stoker and Irving. And in the screenplay, I had scenes in which actual verbatim scenes from the novel were performed. So Lee, for the first time in decades, actually agreed to play Dracula in this film that I wanted to make, which was in the framing device of Sir Henry Irving playing Count Dracula. So there were scenes that had never been put on film taken from the novel. And so he was very enthusiastic about that for the reason that you're mentioning, is that he actually revered the character and thought he could finally give it the proper tribute. But unfortunately, we could not get the financing together in time and the insurance for the film, so we didn't end up making it. But he did agree to do it, and he was very enthusiastic about wanting to play this dual role of Sir Henry Irving. And I depicted the relationship between Stoker and Irving similar to Renfield and Dracula, because Irving was like the lord and master of Bram Stoker, who was very submissive and almost like his servant. And I think, you know, there was a sort of weird psychological dynamic that in their life that went into Dracula. So that was the other project we collaborated on, but unfortunately never came to pass.
And I wanted to, on this subject of Dracula and Christopher Lee, my understanding too, and maybe he talked to you about this at one point, people always wonder why he did those later Dracula films. And my understanding from people I've talked to was that a lot of jobs were on the line with those movies, because that was Hammer's cash cow. And a lot of times he did it just for the people who worked on those films.
No, yeah, he told me the story was that I believe the Michael Carreras, who was the executive who ran Hammer during the period of the later films, I think that was who, would call him. And Lee would, after Dracula, Prince of Darkness in 1965, he was very dissatisfied with the way Dracula was portrayed in that, practically, you know, not given any lines of dialogue, barely used really, although it's an effective film. He wasn't happy with that film, and he was increasingly unhappy with each one that came up. So by the time of the sequel to that one, which was 1968's Dracula Has Risen from the Grave, the producer of Hammer called him. This is what Lee told me, and would say, you know, Lee would say, look, for no amount of money am I going to be in another of these films unless you stick to the script and make it a real character and actually develop the character of Dracula. He's not just going to stand around hissing and wearing red contact lenses, which is what he complained was all he had to do. There was really no theatrical challenge anymore. And the producer said, but if you don't do it, Christopher, all, you know, the makeup people will be out of work. The secretaries for it, Hammer depends on you. And at that point, Hammer had to sell in advance. What they would do is design a flashy poster for a film that didn't exist yet. They would sell the poster to Warner, the gigantic film company in America, Warner 7 Arts, and then they would get the financing to make a film based on the poster. And of course, if it didn't say Christopher Lee as Dracula, they wouldn't get enough money. So basically, Christopher said that they kept blackmailing him, or extorting him rather. You have to play the part or these people will lose their job, which was true to a certain extent. So yeah, he did it with increasing lack of enthusiasm. And of course, the films got worse and worse, though his performances are good. And there are, you know, interesting artistic touches here and there, even in the later ones. So that's why he was eager and enthusiastic to play Dracula in his old age. He was in his 70s when I knew him well and was working with him on that, to play Dracula as the old man with a mustache that he is portrayed by Stoker.
Right, right. And I mean, there's so many areas you can go into with that.
Well, one thing about Lee is that I do have to point out, we were friendly and we had a rapport, but when I contacted him, Forrest J. Ackerman even warned me of his temperament and his moodiness. And this is notorious in the film industry. He could be very arrogant and very pompous. And I saw that side of him eventually. But I'm sure your listeners and you have probably heard that about him. He could be very aloof and biting. And I saw that side of him. So it's important to, it wasn't always completely an easy relationship with him. And that's true with anyone that knew him.
Well, oddly enough, that's sort of what I was, the direction I was going in, because I was going to ask you, you know, an aspect of Christopher Lee that a lot of people don't know about is, much like Dennis Wheatley, who did these sort of conservative novels that attacked black magic and Satanism being on the rise in Britain, I think that Christopher Lee had a very negative opinion of the occult that he shared with Dennis Wheatley. And again, Lee appeared in some of the adaptations of Wheatley's work, most famously The Devil Rides Out and To the Devil a Daughter.
Mm-hmm. No, well, imagine this, is that on a personal level, in that's absolutely true. Let me just underscore the point you're making. Dennis Wheatley was a Tory, for your American listeners, you know, arch reactionary conservative, supporter of the monarchy, conservative values all the way, you know, believed that the British Empire should return. Dennis Wheatley's novels attacking Satanism are really often attacking communism or, you know, perils to the British Empire. So now Lee had met Wheatley in 1959, he told me, at Harrods, the famous department store, which is right down the block from Christopher Lee's apartment house, which at that time, Boris Karloff and Lee were neighbors. They lived in the same apartment house in the Belgravia district of London.
So Lee, is that how they ended up in? They ended up in a few films together, like The Curse of the Crimson Altar. You know?
No, it wasn't because of their personal relationship, and they were good friends. They were even in a film called Corridors of Blood in, you know, early on. They made a few films together, but it wasn't because of their personal friendship. It was just the, you know, production company wanting to put their names on the marquee. And unfortunately, Curse of the Crimson Altar doesn't even give them much screen time together. So in either case, Wheatley, his attacks on Satanism and occultism, Lee 100% was like that. But imagine how weird our relationship would be, because he was very familiar with my background and my deep involvement at that time. Although even by the time I met him, I was sort of moving out of my devil worship period. But he knew of Zena's relationship. And now, the thing is, through Sammy Davis Jr., who was a very good friend of Christopher Lee for his whole life, because Christopher Lee had appeared as the devil in a horror comedy pilot for a TV show in America called Poor Devil. Are you aware of that?
Yes, I've seen it. Sammy Davis Jr. stars as sort of a bumbling devil character with Jack Klugman as the sort of foolish mortal character in it.
Exactly. And so Christopher Lee plays the devil in Poor Devil, and Sammy Davis Jr. was in it. And at that time, a representative of the Church of Satan, under LaVey's request, went to Sammy Davis to a performance and gave Sammy Davis an honorary membership to the Church of Satan. And Sammy Davis, because LaVey, who was basically a pimp, really, introduced Sammy Davis to women and brought him women, Davis became interested in the Church of Satan to a minor degree and was enthusiastic enough about it to give an autographed copy of the Satanic Bible to Christopher Lee. Now, Christopher Lee, coming from this very Tory conservative hatred of occultism approach, wanted nothing to do with it. And Lee showed me his autographed copy of the Satanic Bible that was in his occult section of his library in his home. And he was, you know, he didn't want anything to do with that. And he even warned Sammy Davis Jr. not to become involved with LaVey. So when he met me and Zena, you can imagine, but he was strangely tolerant and very open-minded. But we had a lot of discussions about ceremonial magic and occultism. And he was in no way an occultist. That's another rumor, that he, you know, was an actual practitioner of the black arts. As you said, quite the contrary. So, you know, we talked about it, and he was, at one point, I even told him that seeing him in the film Hercules in the Haunted World, the Mario Bava film, where he plays a black magician, inspired me as a child to want to become a black magician, and he was fairly appalled by that. So that gives you an idea of how, you know, I wouldn't say he was a deeply believing Christian, but he was definitely an anti-occultist whose interpretation of devil worship and Satanism was exactly as you said, from a Dennis Wheatley novel.
Right. And I'm sure you have like a million and one, you know, interesting stories about conversations you probably had about, you know, black magic or ceremonial magic.
Well, not only black magic and ceremonial magic, which he knew a great deal about, and he knew through Dennis Wheatley had told him about his dealings with Rudolf Hess when he was a captive in Scotland, because they actually got Aleister Crowley to advise British intelligence, what should we ask Rudolf Hess about German occultism? So he, and because he was also in intelligence, as was Dennis Wheatley, he was also related to Ian Fleming. So we talked about espionage. We talked about World War II. You know, really, it's a whole book in itself. Some of his anecdotes were questionable, as I found out after he died. He did embellish many of his wartime experiences, but he certainly had a full and eventful life and was a great raconteur. So yeah, there are a million stories.
Well, that does it for the second part of Parallax View's epic three-part conversation with Nicholas Schreck. In part three, things will get a little bit controversial as we talk about Nicholas's work on the Charles Manson case, particularly his attempts to iron out the final chapter of the Manson family story in light of Charlie's death. In addition, we'll speak a little bit about Nicholas's notoriety for his involvement with the American far-right and skinhead culture of the late 80s and early 90s. I think it'll be the part of the conversation that pisses off pretty much everyone, regardless of their politics, right or left. But you'll have to hear it for yourself, folks. And with that said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say, don't do it, just to prohibit. If nothing else, if we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.